You're listening to A Light at the Other Side, where we're sharing stories of resilience, healing, and hope. We share the experiences of adoptees, domestic violence survivors, military veterans, and more, so some episodes may contain potentially triggering accounts of trauma. To fully appreciate the light, we must sometimes peer into the dark. In today's episode, I am thrilled to be reading the works of one of the contributing writers to my publication, Adoptere. With the moniker Callie Lou, Callie Fox Yergel has contributed several moving, insightful pieces to shed light on her firsthand experience as an adoptee. Adoption is a complicated beast, but it's important to note that only within the past decade or so have we as a society actually heard, or should I say listened to, the voices of adoptees. Considering adoptees are at the very heart of the institution of adoption, our experiences are inarguably the most valuable contribution to the discussion to date. I'll be reading two of Callie's pieces, concluding with one of my own on the topic. My life began and ended on the same day. Happy birthday to me, an adoptee's celebration. By Callie Lou. Birthdays are a big deal. It's a day to celebrate the creation of life, your life, while reflecting on the past and making goals for the future to come. It's a time to acknowledge personal growth and give expression to the gratitude of living the life you were given. It is a day for parents to reminisce on your arrival and relive the emotions of the heartstring tugs your life gave them, the joy and magic of a new existence to be nurtured by love and guided with compassion. The day I was born, I was taken away. My birthday has come on the same day in April since 1977, 4 months before open adoptions became legal in Minnesota. My adoption was closed and sealed tightly. That was the established protocol then, to ensure birth mothers and their families did not solicit dishonor for this creation of life, as though it is not a sacred experience, but rather a mistake to get rid of so everyone's life can carry on without interruption. My adoptive mom was a beautiful woman inside and out and devoted her life to children both as a mother and a grade school teacher. She understood the importance of celebrating life, and my life was the blessing she had prayed for. My memories of the birthday parties she planned for me are as crisp as though 47 years have not passed by this year. I can even remember the birthday outfits I wore. She got me one special as each birthday came, and I always felt just as special wearing them as though she had sewed them herself with love. She would organize games for me and my friends, turning the living room into an adolescent playground and camp for a night of scary movies, followed by a pancake breakfast the next morning. She was our audience for the dance routines we would choreograph and capture it all on her bulky camcorder so their memories would remain forever. As a child, my birthday never came with the thought that this was the day I was given away. It shouldn't come with that thought. My adoptive parents celebrated me for being me, and they celebrated me for being theirs. They were my parents, and I was their child. As I got older and more clearly understood not only what adoption was, but also why I was a child of adoption, I began to reflect on my birthday a little bit differently each year. It was no longer just a day to celebrate the creation of my life. It transformed into a day where I pondered if my biological mom had ever held me in her arms. Did we share a fleeting moment of connection before I was taken away? When I gave birth to my first child, the medical staff explained to me the importance of placing my baby directly on my chest, skin to skin. The transition from the mother's womb to an unprotected world is distressing, and experts believe that skin-on-skin contact assists in stabilizing the baby's heart and breathing rates. Furthermore, research has shown how a newborn's cries will often cease when reintroduced to their mother, a sure sign of the need for a mother's protection and security, and undeniable proof that those first moments of life can have an undeniable impact on the well-being of the child. Research on a group of children at age 10 found advantages for those who received skin-to-skin care, including improved attachment behavior, reduced anxiety for both the mother and the child, as well as better reasoning abilities in children long-term. When I was born in the late 70s, it was usual for the mother and child to not even see or have contact with each other. A sheet would be placed between the mother and her child, leaving only a cry to be heard, and then your baby was gone.
This creates what is called preverbal trauma for the child, or as one adoptee concluded, an adoptee experiences their first death at birth. Let the grieving begin. As a society, we don't even let puppies leave their mothers until they are ready. Why do we rip human babies from their mothers so abruptly? Did my mother even hold me? I can't help but question if my anxious attachment style would have manifested differently if she had been allowed even a few minutes to let me feel her skin and hear her heartbeat with mine. I do know that she had a difficult time giving me up. That was one small piece of vague information that was provided to me on a single piece of paper that was supposed to have some sort of solace for me to have. If that is true, which I'm inclined to believe it is because I can't imagine the pain of giving your child away, I wonder each year, too, if she thinks about me. What does my birthday mean to her? My ex-sister-in-law gave up a baby for adoption as a teenager. As a member of a highly religious family, she was sent away to live with her brother in a faraway state. The humiliation of her unrefined behavior and her bastard child was something to deny and erase with adoption as her only allowable option and returned home without her child. She named him after the brother who took her in during her pregnancy and has cried every year on his birthday for the last 44 years. Does my mother cry for me? Does she even think about me? I have always liked to believe that she does, but something I will likely never know, so I'll just keep believing. I don't even know if she's still alive to think about me. I reflected a lot on my birthday this year, just a few days ago, and it didn't sit all comfortably with me. I couldn't place why 47 of all arbitrary ages hit me with despondency. I examined the unsettling emotions of having two adult children, my daughter turned 18 this year and my son is 23, and how that may be affecting a sense of motherhood loss and aging, but I know I will always be in my children's lives. I kept them out of jail, have one graduating from high school and one graduating college, so I think I did an okay job to send them off into the world. My biological mother sent me off into the world the day I was born, leaving my future up to someone else. She didn't see my first steps, hear my first word, or help me blow out my birthday candles, let alone see me through achievements and failures. Maybe a part of my sentiments, the feeling of a loss of motherhood, has given me a new perspective to consider what that felt like for my biological mother, and I can empathize with that pain now, albeit in an entirely incomparable way. With both of my adoptive parents deceased, maybe the sensation of being an orphan again has hit me in a way to meditate on a parent-child relationship and how much I miss my living connections with them. With adoption laws changing nationwide, I will finally have the right to my original birth certificate in a few months. Maybe the prospect of having something as simple as a name that may provide me with a missing puzzle piece or acknowledge my unanswered questions has me speculating on a new and more complete view of life. I don't know any of these answers, but I've lived my entire life without answers, so I suppose I need to be okay without resolve. This is a birthday gift I will never receive. Happy birthday to me. Is assigning a blank life to a child ethical? What we don't know does hurt us. The genetic uncertainty of being an adoptee. By Callie Liu. As I was writing a recent article titled, I Have Been Unknowingly Living with ADHD My Entire Life, I composed it off the top of my head, letting words flow out of me as they came. The article was not only for my readers to gain perspective on being suddenly recognized as neurodivergent as a middle-aged woman, but it was also beneficial for me to take a glimpse back over the last 46 years through the lens of this new diagnosis and put some pieces of my puzzle together. The burning question is, how did something like aggressive ADHD go unnoticed when we know it is an affliction that manifests in childhood and carries with us throughout our adult years? My method in writing about it was to try and figure that out to the best of my ability and what it meant to me. All the signs were there, looking back from the inability to concentrate, properly process emotions, or systematically categorize stimuli from the world around me. I had been diagnosed with anxiety after a bad LSD trip as a teenager, truthfully assuming I had irrevocably damaged myself because of it and conditioned myself to simply endure the struggles it created for me. There could still be some truth in that theory, as could a brain injury I suffered in a car accident 2 years before my bad trip to hell, but as I let my unrestrained thoughts flow out of me, I wrote this. As I have begun this reconditioning process, a lot of questions have arisen in me. It is still relatively unknown why ADHD makes an appearance in some individuals, and research has led to genetics being the sole answer. I don't know my genetics. I'm adopted. I can't help but think that having had that knowledge could have improved the succession of my life on a dramatic level. The fact that my biological background is still locked away in a file, having no rights to it, infuriates me in an entirely different regard now. That is my information. The withholding of it has brought me nothing but disharmony and internal conflict. Was this genetic inevitability? Was it? Is it? Let me repeat. I don't know my genetics. I am adopted. I can't help but think that having had that knowledge could have improved the succession of my life on a dramatic level. I have lived my entire life without any essential information concerning my biological identity, and the uncertainty of my genetics leaves me vulnerable in many ways, especially when it concerns hereditary conditions, and it leads me to ask a question I've never investigated before. Is assigning a blank life to a child ethical? When considering adoption, I can't help but wonder if the best interest of the child is actually considered, or if the entire system is designed to simply spare the biological parents, or more so their families, shame, while essentially auctioning off an unintended creation of human life. Who feels the shame then? My daughter works with a young autistic woman at a local retail store where a group of teenage boys zealously walked in while in the middle of a conversation they had started outside. They were discussing adoptees without abandon, and certainly without intellect, making loud remarks about how adoptees are bastards and laughing about the hilarity of someone not being wanted by their parents. What losers adoptees are. They don't even have a life worth living. This young autistic girl broke into tears and ran into the back room where my daughter followed, asking her what was wrong. Her unwitting and impressionable mind cried tears of sorrow as she explained how she was adopted and overheard the vile things being obnoxiously spewed about by the group of boys. She asked, "Does that mean I'm not wanted? I'm a bastard?" That is the shame that adoptees are subject to and often already possess, not to mention the complete lack of discernment from the rest of society like these feeble-minded boys. My daughter embraced her and told her about me, her own mom, who was also adopted many years ago, and grew into adulthood knowing next to nothing about where I came from. She counseled her to the best of her ability from what she had learned from my experience and the knowledge she had acquired from how I interpreted life as an adoptee. She shared with her how my biological father joined the army and left, truly not wanting anything to do with me, but that the family I was given to did, just like hers, and that's what's important to remember. I cried when she told me this story, proud of her ability to dignify this girl's life and respect the despair it brought her. My beautiful soothsayer daughter concluded the conversation by asserting how my genetic mystery is a part of her too, and in that she was able to empathize. She was right. My genetic mystery is no doubt a part of her, and she has unanswered questions too. She got my eyes, my body shape, my anxiety, and my sensitivity to emotions, but where did all those similarities originate from? We don't know. We don't know if heart health should be a concern or if we should screen for cancer early. We don't know if our brains will fail us one day with Alzheimer's or Parkinson's will rob us of stability. Not that anyone, adopted or not, knows what life has in store for them. But genetics can reveal an abundance of preventative knowledge, and with it, peace of mind. We don't have the right to preventative measures like others do, and I bet you never thought of it that way. Society is unflinching to state their position that those of color, sexual orientation, religion, or otherwise should have the same rights as everyone else, so why not adoptees? It would be unethical to tell a transgender person that they don't have rights to their personal history because they chose to change their gender from the one given them at birth. It would likewise be unethical to tell a Jewish person that their past doesn't matter, just throw that whole Holocaust thing under the rug and forget about it. Slavery? Psh, doesn't make a difference in who you are today. History tells us an important story of why and how the world with all of us in it came to be the society and people we are today. We look to history to find answers to current dilemmas and to expand our understanding of existence. Why are adoptees not allowed history? Is assigning a blank life to a child ethical? I can't help but think that having had that knowledge would have improved the succession of my life on a dramatic level. If not adoption, then what? The Humane Alternative to Contemporary Adoption and What It Means for Children, by Melissa Corrigan. But what if the parents are abusive? Then what? We leave the child with them? Every time I engage in a discussion with someone about adoption, a discussion in which I feel it's important to note that I am an adoptee and they are not, this scenario is brought up. Every time I sigh, always jumping to the most extreme situation to make decisions for the entire industry. Okay. And I begin breaking down what an adoption truly is. The circumstances in which children are adopted are as varied as stars in the sky. Some are outright scared pregnant teens or young women who feel they don't have a choice. So let's start there. When we break it down, systemic poverty plays an enormous role in this. This can't be emphasized enough. If all women in America had universal health care, paid maternity leave, and affordable child care and housing, I'm willing to bet my bottom dollar that the vast majority of those mothers, the ones who did not or could not abort, would keep their babies. Systemic poverty is one of the largest blocks to mothers keeping their children, point blank, period, full stop. To claim to be pro-life and to also be against dismantling systemic poverty is to be a liar and a hypocrite. The front side of this situation has to be addressed as well. Robust sex education and access to birth control have been proven to drastically drive down teen pregnancy rates. Youth who are educated about their bodies do better and make smarter choices. To claim to be pro-life and to also be against robust, factual sex education and access to birth control is also to be a liar and a hypocrite. So now let's get into the more complicated situations, the situations in which abuse and neglect are cited as reasons to remove a child or children from their mother's care. I worked at a residential treatment facility for children with emotional and behavioral issues, most derived from neglect and trauma. I saw firsthand the results of children being in those situations, and we're going to set aside the fact that I personally experienced it. I heard stories that made my hair stand on end, and the fact that it was a parent who committed these atrocities to their own children is unconscionable. No child should be left with an abusive person. I think absolutely everyone can agree on that point. So what should be done with them? Most developed nations, much like on the topic of slavery, have come to the determination years ago that adoption is not the best way to handle these situations. They have collectively determined, with vast amounts of research and also input from the adoptees themselves, that legal guardianship is a more appropriate solution. In fact, in the reference document from the European Union Agency for Fundamental Rights, Guardianship for Children Deprived of Parental Care, adoption is never mentioned as a solution, not once. The word adoption is merely mentioned 6 times in the 120-page document, and even then, it's only mentioned in reference to the policing of intercountry adoption, adoptions taking place in the United States, and with children being removed from foreign nations and taken to homes in the U.S. Conversely, the word rights is mentioned 136 times. It's evident that all other developed nations place the inherent rights of the child far above the rights of adopters. It takes that lead from the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, which ironically for me, was passed in 1989, the year of my adoption. This resolution was passed the same year my rights were decimated by a court in the state of South Carolina within the United States, which chose to not adhere to that particular resolution. Article 8 is particularly important. It states, states parties undertake to respect the right of the child to preserve his or her identity, including nationality, name, and family relations as recognized by law without unlawful interference. Where a child is illegally deprived of some or all of the elements of his or her identity, states parties shall provide appropriate assistance and protection with a view to reestablishing speedily his or her identity. Subsection 3 of Article 9 is also highly pertinent in this conversation with the United States. It reads, states parties shall respect the right of the child who is separated from one or both parents to maintain personal relations and direct contact with both parents on a regular basis, except if it's contrary to the child's best interest. These articles go on to enumerate several rights for children who are under the care of legal guardians, rights which would be considered absurd in America if we demanded them for children in our foster care and adoption systems. This includes, beyond the right to identity and connection with our biological family, the right to seek and practice our own chosen religion and never be forced to practice the religion of the legal guardian, the right to seek and be provided cultural books and other media to learn about one's own culture and heritage and never be forced to adhere to the culture and heritage of a legal guardian, the right to be free from all forms of physical or mental violence, injury or abuse, neglect or negligent treatment, maltreatment or exploitation, including sexual abuse, while in the care of a legal guardian. Boy, did we miss the mark on that last one. Rates of abuse among adoptees are unfathomably high, but finding adequate statistics to prove this is extraordinarily difficult as A, adoptees simply are not asked, seriously, and B, many, many adoptees have internalized shame, responsibility, and loyalty to their abusers, and thus are less likely to report abuse and mistreatment, especially decades after the fact, and especially after their abusers have died. I fully believe that only over the coming two decades will we even begin to discover the true depth and breadth of abuse among adoptees in America, as adoptees are just beginning to speak to one another, open up, and the truth is just beginning to emerge. Adoptees in their 70s and 80s are just sharing their stories of trauma within adoptive homes. They have carried these secrets for well over half a century. The truth will take just as long to fully emerge. So again, if not adoption, then what? Slavery in America was also heralded as harmless and necessary for society, even well after all other developed nations had ceased and outlawed the practice. The reason? Profit. I have no doubt that adoption will follow in this path, for the practice of taking children, erasing their identities, placing them in inherently abusive environments, and continuing to deny them access to their own identity, even into adulthood, is not only morally and ethically repugnant, it goes against the laws of man and the accepted practices and formal statutes in every other nation of the world. Legal guardianship, however, is a common practice when a child cannot, for whatever reason, remain in the care of their parents. Legal guardianship assures several things. The child will have a safe place to live, food to eat, clothing to wear, and access to education and health care. Legal guardianship also assures several things that adoption expressly excludes. Freedom from having to submit to a religion they do not follow or believe in, and the protected right to continue observing the religion of their birth. The right to retain their birth identity, including name, family line, culture, and heritage, while being protected from being forced to assimilate into the culture or heritage of the legal guardian. The protected right to know and have regular communication with their parents and other biological family members, so long as harm is not occurring. Harm being physical, verbal, or sexual abuse, not merely knowing their mother has a drug problem or their father is incarcerated. In fact, incarcerated parents are provided for in the aforementioned UNCRC as a protected group. And freedom from being physically, verbally, or sexually abused while in the care of a legal guardian. In short, the fundamental difference between adoption and legal guardianship is whose interests are placed center. Can anyone logically argue that the best interest of the child includes stripping their name, refusing to allow them to know their family, culture, and heritage, forcing them to observe a religion they do not inherently observe, while simultaneously refusing to allow them to practice their religion or cultural practices, denying them identifying information even into adulthood, and subjecting them to almost certain trauma? Adoption is itself inherently traumatic, even in the best cases. If you would argue that, yes, that's the best interest of the child, then I hate to tell you, you're arguing for slavery all over again. This is precisely what was done to slaves in America as a matter of routine, And there were even people who argued that it was best for the slaves, that the institution of slavery provided housing and food for those, quote, immigrants, and they should be, any guesses? Grateful. Which, ironically, is exactly what's told to us adoptees when we detail years of abuse in the homes of these benevolent adopters, that we should be grateful for the roof, food, and clothing. As an adoptee, gee, thanks. It's beyond time to address this situation. The United States of America could do well to look to the established, for over 30 years now, guidance and practices of legal guardianship and abolish adoption once and for all. But like most harmful things in America, so long as it makes someone money, getting rid of it will be an incredibly difficult uphill battle. The interconnectedness of the conservative Christian community with the adoption industry makes this all the more difficult. When there are people delusional enough to believe that their infertility gives them a divine right to take someone else's child, projecting onto the situation their religious fantasies that the child is somehow a gift from God, not to the child's mother, but to them, actual strangers. And there are thousands of for-profit adoption agencies standing ready to trade a human child for $10,000, $15,000, or $20,000, or even more, to fulfill that religious delusion. We are clearly wading waist-deep in human trafficking territory, and this needs to be stopped. Immediately. One needs look no further than the websites and social media posts of for-profit adoption agencies who market their, quote, available children, and these people comment under their pictures indicating their interest, much as is done with posts advertising puppies or kittens. This isn't exaggeration or fiction. It's absolutely real. Nothing about that industry is concerned with the well-being of the child, only with fulfilling the greedy adopter's desire to own a human child. It's positively mind-blowing that so many of those people won't drink coffee unless it's fair trade and concern themselves with the ethical treatment of migrant workers while they harbor a child in their home that's neither fair trade nor ethically sourced. Let's sit with that for a moment. Are we as a society more concerned with the trade of coffee beans than human children? Because by all accounts and statistics, we are. Are you comfortable with that? If you'd like to advocate for the establishment of legal guardianship and the abolishment of adoption, you should go to my website. I have links under the Advocacy tab where you can find your local representative and send them an email to that end. Feel free to cite this article and, more important, the established guidance of the UN that is quoted and linked therein. It's beyond time to demand the stop of the trafficking of children, the stripping of their identities and rights, and to step up to the best practices that have been established decades ago around the globe for the protection of children. Join me in auditing the narrative of adoption and demanding a better option. The children of America and globally will thank you. I always appreciate you tuning in. From wherever you are in the nation or in the world. I have a map that places a glowing red dot everywhere someone has listened, and the entire globe is lighting up. I am thrilled, humbled, and honored. If you'd like your story read on my podcast, please go to melissacorrigan.com and shoot me a message there. I'd be honored to share your story. If you're listening, no matter where, consider joining the Facebook group for listeners. It's linked in the description to every episode. Also consider giving my other podcast a listen. Launched just last week, Does She Shut Up? Is a raw commentary on life in America from the viewpoint of a woman, mother, veteran, and basically voter. You can head to my Substack, Does She Shut Up? To subscribe and listen in. As always, thank you for sharing this time with me, and I'll see you next week.